speaking to us on the role of counterfactual dependence in causal judgments.
Yeah, no, there's a slightly different title. It's the role of counterfactual reasoning in causal judgments. Okay, so what's the connection between causation and counterfactuals? And here I'm going to be talking about actual or token causation. That's the focus of my paper. One idea which has been much discussed in philosophy, psychology, the law, is that there's an analytic connection between causal statements, such as the form C cause D, and a counterfactual form, if C hadn't occurred, then E wouldn't have occurred. And so this idea, I guess, has been explored in some length for, I guess, the last 30 or 40 years. The consensus among philosophers seems to be that it's very difficult to analyze causation in terms of such counterfactuals. And the main problem that's been discussed by philosophers are examples of preemption. Preemption seems to pose a real problem for counterfactual theories of causation. Among psychologists, at least the ones that I've read who work on counterfactual reasoning and causal reasoning, the consensus seems to be that the counterfactual judgments and the causal judgments are dissociated. These people that I've read, David Mandel and Ruth Byrne, who work on counterfactual and causal reasoning, cite a lot of data that seems to suggest that causal reasoning and causal judgments are dissociated from our judgments about counterfactuals. They argue that causal judgments seem to go with judgments about productive mechanisms, about productions, about sufficient conditions, whereas counterfactuals of this form seem to go with judgments about enabling conditions and preventative sort of mechanisms. What I want to do in this paper is to argue that philosophers and psychologists have been a bit premature in dismissing the idea that there might be a close conceptual connection between these two forms of judgments. But I think what we have to do is we have to be much more subtle and indirect about establishing a connection between counterfactual reasoning and causal reasoning. So what I'm going to do very roughly is to say something about David Lewis's counterfactual theory, which is the theory that philosophers have mostly talked about in the last 40 years. And I'm not going to talk about the preemption problems that a lot of philosophers have talked about. What I want to do is talk about a kind of cluster of problems about the distinction between enabling conditions and causes and the distinction between positive and negative events. There's a whole kind of cluster of problems there for Lewis's theory, and I want to sort of concentrate on them. Then I'm going to look at a couple of attempts to rescue the counterfactual theory from this cluster of problems, a theory by Chris Hitchcock and Josh Knobe, and a theory of James Woodward. And hopefully, if I've got time, I'll try to outline an approach which I think is a better approach to those theories. Okay, so Lewis's theory is fairly straightforward, so I'll go through this material rather quickly. So Lewis defines causation in terms of counterfactual dependence, and that's defined as follows, that E counterfactually depends on C, if and only if C were to occur, E would occur, and if C weren't to occur, E wouldn't occur. And these counterfactuals are understood in terms of a similarity relation between possible worlds. Now Lewis imposes a requirement on the counterfactual such that this first counterfactual, if C were to occur, E would occur, is automatically true when C occurs and E occurs. The counterfactual is true if the antecedent is true and the consequent is true. So this enables us to simplify the definition of counterfactual dependence to this a definition here, where you just use the second counterfactual. And then Lewis defines causation in terms of a chain of counterfactual dependences between distinct existences or between distinct events. Now, the crucial feature of Lewis's theory for what I want to say is that it turns out to be a sufficient condition for causation that there's a single counterfactual dependence between of E on C. If E counterfactual depends on C, then that is sufficient for C to be a cause of E. Now, let me just go through a whole range of problems which are mostly familiar for Lewis's theory. One of the problems is that Lewis's theory seems to gloss over the distinction between enabling conditions and causes. So a familiar problem is a man is born and later dies in a car accident. If he hadn't had the car accident, he wouldn't have died. So the car accident counts as a cause of his death. But also his birth counts as a cause of his death, because if he hadn't been born, he wouldn't have been alive, and he wouldn't have had the car. He wouldn't have died. So the birth as well as the car accident counts as a cause. Now, one of the features of Lewis's theory is it allows omissions and absences as cause. This is viewed as by many people as a real virtue of the theory, and I guess I regard that as a real virtue of the theory. Many theories of causation don't allow absences as causes or effects, but Lewis's does. But once he allows absences and omissions as causes, that complicates the problem of the overgeneration of causes. Take a little example here. I'm writing this paper at my computer, but if I'd been struck by a meteor, I wouldn't be writing this essay. So it counts that as a cause of my writing the essay, the failure of a meteor strike to hit me, or the failure of a madman to attack me with a flamethrower. There are lots of absences which are going to count as causes of my writing the paper. And another familiar example is Lewis. We treat some omissions as genuine causes and others as spurious causes, and Lewis has trouble distinguishing these two. So another familiar example is the old gardener and the plant. The gardener, whose job it is to water a plant during hot weather, fails to do so and the plant dies. If the gardener had watered the plant, then the plant would have survived. So the gardener's failure counts as a cause. That's okay. But notice that if the Queen had, the Queen of England had watered the plants, the plant would have survived as well. So the Queen's failure to water the plant also counts as a cause in Lewis's theory, and that seems counterintuitive. Okay. So all of those are familiar examples and familiar problems. There's some nice examples that are discussed by Carolina Sartorio in a paper that I think is unpublished yet, but it's on her website, and it's called The Prince of Wales Problem. It's a kind of riff on these early examples about the Queen of England. So there are actually two halves of this problem. There's the problem of unwanted positive causes. So the queen has asked the prince to water her pot plant. This is actually, potted plant, not her dope plant. To water her potted plant in the afternoon. But his priorities are to eat oaten biscuits instead of watering the plant, and so the plant dies. So the prince's failure to water counts as a cause on Lewis's theory. But now add the supposition that that if the prince hadn't eaten the oaten biscuits, he would have watered the plants. Well, if he hadn't eaten the oaten biscuits, he would have watered the plants, and the plants would have survived. So it turns out that the positive event of the prince's eating the oaten biscuits counts as a cause as well. And this is a problem for Lewis's theory, because one of the sort of motivations for Lewis's theory for incorporating omissions and absences as causes is that he argues that there are no positive events that can actually occupy the causal role of these omissions and absences. But here it turns out that that whenever you have a negative cause, there's going to be a positive cause as well. The other half of the Prince of Wales problem is, I think, a more serious problem. It's the prince eats the oaten biscuits instead of watering the plants, but he eats so many biscuits he gets a stomach ache. The prince's eating too many oaten biscuits was a cause of his stomach ache. But notice that so too is his failure to water the plant. If he had watered the plant instead of eating the oaten biscuits, then he wouldn't have got the stomach ache. That's the way this works. But notice that again you get an overgeneration of omissions as causes. Any action which is precluded, which is ruled out by the prince's eating the oaten sort of biscuits, such as his talking to the duke, is walking in the garden, is riding his horse. All of those things that are precluded by his eating the oaten biscuits will have an omission that counts as a cause of the stomach ache. And that seems very implausible. It's his eating the oaten biscuits, too many of them, that was the cause of the stomach ache, not his omission, not his failure to do all these other things. Okay, so these problems seem to indicate that the counterfactual is not a sufficient condition for causation. At least that's what I think is the case. Now, Lewis himself was aware of some of these problems, and he argued that actually they're not real problems for his theory, that all of the counterfactual statements and the causal statements are true, but they're irrelevant for conversational purposes. So he uses Grice's maxims of relevance to explain why, even while these statements are true, they're not particularly appropriate for us to assert. But it seems to me that this is not a very satisfactory way of proceeding. When you look at this kind of cluster of problems, there seem to be specific principles which are underlying our causal judgments here. And it would be very nice if we could actually capture those causation-specific principles rather than rely on this general pragmatic machinery. Now, there's a theory that Chris Hitchcock and Josh Knobe have developed in a 2009 paper, came out in Journal of Philosophy, called Cause and Norm, which has some very nice features. It's a pragmatic theory which explains our judgments in all of these, in these cases, while retaining the idea that counterfactual dependence is central to the concept of causation. So the theory appeals to findings in the literature on psychological availability of counterfactual suppositions. There's a fairly extensive literature in psychology which investigates the circumstances in which people spontaneously generate counterfactuals or accept counterfactuals that are presented to them. So they're very systematic investigation of when people make counterfactual judgments. And one of the most robust findings in this literature is that people are disposed to entertain counterfactual hypotheses that undo the past by changing an abnormal actual occurrence into a normal counterfactual one or a counterfactual normal one. But seldom, if ever, do they mentally undo the past by changing normal occurrences into abnormal ones. So that's very sort of robust finding in this literature. And it goes back, this literature really goes back to a paper by Kahneman, Tversky, called The Simulation Heuristic. And they gave, they had a little study where they gave subjects a story describing a fatal road accident in which a truck ran a red light and crashed into a passing car that kills its occupant, Mr. Jones. So the two versions of the story that were presented to subjects. In one version, Mr. Jones left his home at the regular time but took an unusual route home. And the other, he took the usual route home but left early to do some chores. Now, in 80% of the responses, subjects indicated they mentally undid the past by mutating the abnormal event and restoring it back to normality. So in the first version of the story, the subjects were inclined to entertain counterfactuals about what would have happened if Mr. Jones had left, had taken the usual route home, and in the second, counterfactuals about what would have happened if Jones had left at his usual time. So the idea is that you explain our judgments in this case by saying that we look for counterfactuals where we undo some abnormal occurrence and convert it into a normal occurrence in the counterfactual antecedent. So Hitchcock and Knobe use this finding to explain our judgments in a number of cases. They don't actually consider the cases that I was looking at. They attend to a different set of examples. But the underlying principle seems to be like this, that we readily accept a causal judgment, C cause D, when the counterfactual, if C hadn't occurred, E wouldn't have occurred. That should be, if C hadn't occurred, E wouldn't have occurred, involves changing an abnormal occurrence into a normal one. So they're accepting that there's a conceptual connection between the causal statement and the counterfactual statement, and then using the empirical findings about the sort of counterfactual availability of certain kinds of counterfactuals to explain the acceptability of the causal judgment. And they argue that when we make these judgments about counterfactuals and about causal statements, we use a kind of single scale of normality to sort events into normal events and abnormal events. And this single scale is a kind of amalgam of different notions of norms. There are statistical norms based on relative frequencies, there are ethical and social norms, there are norms of proper functioning when you're talking about artifacts and biological organisms. All of these different kind of normative considerations get amalgamated into a single scale. So here's an example they talk about. That's been discussed quite a lot. So subjects are presented with a vignette in which a receptionist in the philosophy department keeps her desk stocked with pens. In contrast to administrative assistants who are permitted to take pens, faculty members are supposed to buy their own. One day, an administrative assistant, Professor Smith, walk past the receptionist's desk and both take pens. Later that day, the receptionist needs to take an important message but can't do so because there are no pens on the desk. When subjects are asked whether the administrative assistant or Professor Smith caused the problem, most subjects say Professor Smith was the cause of the problem. And perhaps some of you filled out this survey. This is an online survey they sent out a few years ago. And there are 3,000 or 4,000 subjects, and about 300 or 400 of those subjects were trained philosophers. Most of the subjects, including the trained philosophers, said that Professor Smith was the problem. And the way in which Hitchcock and Noeb explain this is they say, well, look at the corresponding counterfactuals. If Professor Smith had taken a pen, there would have been no... if Professor Smith had not taken a pen, there would have been no problem. That's okay. That involves a norm-restoring antecedent. And so the corresponding causal judgment is acceptable. On the other hand, the counterfactual, if the administrative assistant had not taken a pen, there would have been no problem. That doesn't involve a norm-restoring antecedent. So that's that counterfactual is less acceptable, less available, and so the corresponding causal judgment is less available. Now, when you look at when you apply this theory to the range of examples that I was using, it does a reasonably good job at explaining a lot of them. And I won't bore you by going through all of them. I'll just mention a couple. Say the absence of the meteor. The absence of the meteor caused me to write this paper. It's not acceptable because the corresponding counterfactual involves changing a normal event into an abnormal event. And that's considered to be not acceptable. We're just not inclined to entertain counterfactuals of that form, so therefore the causal judgment is not acceptable. Or take the Prince of Wales problem. This is the unwanted positive cause. This is the case where the prince's failure to water the plants was the cause of the plant's death. We want to say that, but we don't want to say is eating the oaten biscuits was the cause of the plant's death. Again, the Hitchcock-Noeb theory has a nice explanation for this. In particular, the prince's eating the oaten biscuits caused the death. That's not acceptable because the corresponding counterfactual, if the prince hadn't eaten the oaten biscuits, the plant wouldn't have died, is not one of the acceptable counterfactuals that involves a norm-restoring antecedent. Now, it seems to me that there are various problems for the Hitchcock and Noeb theory. One of them is that when you actually look at all the examples, there are true counterfactuals for the causes and the non-causes. So in the simple example about the gardener and the plant, it's true that if the gardener watered the plant would have survived. It's also true if the queen had watered the plant would have survived. So the counterfactuals are true. So what Hitchcock and Noeb have to do is use this this sort of pragmatic filter of relevance to sort out the causation signifying counterfactuals for ones that don't signify counterfactuals. So there's a kind of pragmatic filter of relevance that they use here, but they never actually explain what relevance amounts to. There are a couple of things that seem to be going on in that paper. First of all, they, like a lot of this literature on psychological availability, sometimes when they talk about available counterfactuals or relevant counterfactuals, they mean the ones that are spontaneously generated, the ones that spring to mind most readily. But it seems to me that's completely irrelevant here, and that this understanding of sort of relevance is completely so immaterial here, because what we want to be able to do is to be able to explain our different causal judgments about these different cases, even when we are consciously entertaining, even when both counterfactuals have sprung to our mind. We need to be able to discriminate the counterfactuals and the causal judgment. And sometimes when they mean relevant, they mean acceptable when explicitly entertained. But if you look at both those counterfactuals, they're equally acceptable when they're entertained. And then sometimes when they mean relevant, they mean counterfactuals that are relevant for practical purposes, that are worth entertaining for practical purposes. But again, it seems to me that where you're talking about the gardener and the queen and they have no practical significance for you, neither of those counterfactuals has any practical significance. So it's very unclear what they mean by the notion of relevance that they use in their pragmatic filter. And another problem is concerns the kind of extensive psychological findings that demonstrate a dissociation between causal judgments and counterfactual judgments. There's a reasonable literature on this. So David Mandel, in a study, used the example about Mr. Jones and the drunk driver. Okay, and when subjects were asked about their counterfactual judgments, a lot of subjects said, well, if only Mr. Jones hadn't taken the unusual route home, then he wouldn't have had the car accident, he wouldn't have died. But when they were asked for their causal judgment, they said something totally different. They said, no, it was the drunk drivers sort of running the red light that was the cause of the car accident and Mr. Jones's death. And Mandel thinks that what's going on is that with causal judgments, they're cued by considerations to do with sufficient conditions and generalizations that license predictions. So there's a prediction, there's a useful generalization that kind of reckless driving leads to accidents and deaths. There's not a useful prediction that you can make on the basis of a person leaving their home or taking an unusual route home. Okay, so there are different kind of recruitment criteria for these judgments according to some of these psychologists. And that seems to cast doubt on whether there's a kind of analytic connection between the causal judgment and the counterfactual judgment. Now, let me go to Woodward's theory. Woodward, again, tries to explain the selectivity of causal judgments by kind of augmenting Lewis's theory. And like Lewis, he defines counterfactual dependence in terms of a pair of counterfactuals. If C were to occur, E would occur. If C weren't to occur, E wouldn't occur. From now on, I'm going to call this first one the occurrence counterfactual, and the second one the non-occurrence counterfactual. And Woodward says that a counterfactual judgment C calls D is acceptable just when the occurrence, the first counterfactual, is insensitive. That is, there's a broad range of background conditions, BI, that are not too improbable or far-fetched, such that the following counterfactual is true. If C were to occur in circumstances BI different from the actual circumstances, then E would occur. Well, this actually notion of sensitive versus insensitive counterfactuals comes from Lewis. And Lewis gives a couple of examples. A case of insensitive causation is if you were to shoot a person at close range with a large caliber bullet, that would cause the person's death. That would be a case of insensitive causation, because if you vary the actual circumstances ever so little, still the shooting of the person at close range will lead to the person's death. A case of insensitive causation for Lewis is a case, suppose he writes a letter of recommendation for job seeker X, and that leads to X getting a job and displaces another job seeker Y who goes to another position, so meets and marries someone, has children, those children have descendants. Now, it's true in Lewis's theory, if Lewis hadn't written the letter of recommendation, then those descendants of Y wouldn't have been born and wouldn't have died. So there's a causal relation here, but Lewis says this is an extremely sensitive causal relation, because if you vary any of the actual circumstances just ever so slightly, then Lewis's writing of the letter won't lead to the death of the job seeker Y. Now, so Woodward links our readiness to accept causal judgment to the degree of insensitivity of the first, the occurrence, counterfactual. And when you look at the examples that I've given, it does explain a number of the causal judgments we make in some of these cases. Suppose you look at the absence of the meteor strike. The absence of the meteor strike caused me to write this paper. That's not acceptable, because the corresponding occurrence counterfactual, if there were no meteor, I would write this paper, is sensitive. And you know, just vary the actual circumstances a little bit so I don't get invited to the conference, then I'm not going to write the paper. So this is a case of a sensitive counterfactual, of a sensitive occurrence counterfactual, so the causal judgment is not acceptable. And he has some kind of interesting observations about that. But I think that that Woodward's theory, again, is not entirely satisfactory. It seems to me it doesn't deal with all the examples that I've been describing. Just take the example of Mr. Jones and the drunk driver. So Mr. Jones is taking an unusual route home, caused his death. That turns out to be unacceptable on the Woodward theory, because it has a sensitive occurrence counterfactual. If you just vary the actual circumstances a little bit so that the drunk driver doesn't run the red light, then Mr. Jones has taken the unusual route home, doesn't lead to his death. So the occurrence counterfactual is sensitive, so the causal judgment is not acceptable. But correspondingly, the drunk driver's sort of running the red light caused Mr. Jones's death also has a sensitive occurrence counterfactual. Just vary the circumstances so that Mr. Jones takes his usual route home, not the unusual route home, then the driver's running the red light is not going to lead to Mr. Jones's death. So in both cases, the occurrence counterfactual is sensitive. So it turns out in Woodward's theory that neither of those events counts as a cause of the car accident, and that seems to be a mistake. And similarly, the theory doesn't handle one half of the Prince of Wales problem. This is the problem about the unwanted positive causes. So this is the case, remember, where the Prince of Wales eats the oat and biscuits instead of watering the plant, and the plant dies. We want to say that his failure to water the plant caused the plant's death, but not his eating the oat and biscuits. We want to say that it's the omission, not the event that he did in place of the omitted event, that counts as the cause. Well, here the prince's failure to water the plant causes death. That's going to come out as true on Woodward's theory. But the problem is that the causal statement about the positive event is going to come out true as well. The prince's eating the oat and biscuits caused the plant's death also has an insensitive occurrence counterfactual. If you look at any variation on the actual circumstances which respects the stipulation that the prince's eating the oat and biscuits precludes him from watering the plant, will make the occurrence counterfactual true. So it's a kind of stipulation of those Prince of Wales problem, that the prince can only do one thing at a time. He can either eat the oat and biscuits or he can water the plants. But if he does one, he can't do the other. So if you respect that stipulation of the counterexample, then any variation on his eating the oat and biscuits will still lead to the plant's death. So And also, I think the Woodward theory has problems with the problem of the professor and the administrative assistant. We want to say the professor's action caused the problem with the receptionist, not the administrative assistant's. But look at the occurrence counterfactual. If the professor were to take the pen, there would be a problem. That turns out to be a sensitive counterfactual, because there seem to be admissible variations in which the professor takes the pen but the administrative assistant doesn't, in which case there'd be no problem. So the theory, Woodward's theory, can't explain our intuitive judgments about the professor and the administrative assistant. So what I want to do here is just kind of sketch a different approach, which is really closer to the Hitchcock and Knobe approach than the Woodward approach. I think Hitchcock and Knobe are actually closer to the truth than Woodward. But the theory kind of differs from the Hitchcock and Knobe account in various respects that I'm only going to have time to sort of mention in brief detail. The Hitchcock and Knobe account is supposed to be a pragmatic rather than a semantic account. The sort of picture that Hitchcock and Knobe have is that the there's something called the objective causal structure. This is Chris's term. That's given by a set of structural equations, and that captures all the objective causal information that's useful for the purposes of prediction and control. That's all you need for those purposes. But we have this kind of strange notion of actual or token causation, which has all these weird contours. And in order to explain the weird contours of the notion of actual causation, Hitchcock and Knobe bring in this pragmatic filter of sort of relevance that sorts out the acceptable counterfactuals and causal judgments from the others. Now, I think it's much better to actually have to build, to see our judgments in these cases as reflecting the semantics rather than the pragmatics of causation. So on the account that I want to present, the meaning of a causal judgment involves a contrast between the actual course of events and a counterfactual course of events. So this is a contrastive account of causation. There are various contrastive accounts of causation, knowledge, and so on. But this is supposed to be a contrastive account. So when we've got this contrast pair of consisting of the actual situation and a counterfactual situation, the actual situation contains an abnormal sequence of events which invites explanation or the ascription of responsibility. So the picture is that in the actual situation, we get a kind of deviation. Something abnormal happens that makes the actual course of events deviate from the normal course of events. The normal course of events is this counterfactual situation that, using the terminology that's common, I'm going to call the default course of events. So if there hadn't been this abnormal event, things would have chugged on along this way, and the situation would have developed in this way. But this is a counterfactual situation, not the actual situation. The actual situation deviates from the default situation by virtue of containing an abnormal sequence of events. And a paradigm case of this, I think, is where we have an intentional action that that's a sort of exogenous interference in the normal course of events that makes the normal course of events deviate. Now, in the kind of formal dressed-up version of the theory, I use a notion of a sort of intervention at this point. There's an intervention that occurs in the normal course of events that brings about the deviation, which is the actual situation. So another difference from the Hitchcock and Knobe theory is that it uses salient counterfactual possibilities rather than relevant counterfactuals. The theory says that in considering a causal judgment, we tacitly treat a certain counterfactual possibility as salient. There's a non-actual possibility that becomes salient to us that we use as a contrast with the actual situation. And when we pick out this counterfactual possibility as a default, this default situation has to meet a certain all-important condition. the counterfactual possibility must be a norm-conforming situation where the actual putative causal event doesn't occur. That's a crucial constraint on the contrast class, that it has to be a norm-conforming counterfactual situation. And as in the Hitchcock and Knope theory, I assume that there's a kind of single scale in terms of which we rank and order events and sequence of events in terms of their normality. And this single scale is an amalgam or involves weighting statistical and ethical norms in a sort of context relative way. But it's important that while the theory uses counterfactual possibilities, non-actual possibilities, it doesn't actually use counterfactuals. Counterfactuals, as they're standardly understood, obey a rule of actuality. They're centered on the actual world. Whereas the non-actual possibility that acts as a contrast is not the kind of possibility that's usually entertained in standard counterfactuals. The contrast default counterfactual possibility is what in normal circumstances would occur were the cause absent. And that's different from what in the actual circumstances would occur if the cause were absent. They're quite different. The actual circumstances which form the base for counterfactual considerations may actually differ from the normal situation. So as we saw earlier in the Hitchcock and Knope theory, their theory generates all the standard counterfactuals, then they have a pragmatic filter. It strikes me that it's much better to just get rid of the detour of using counterfactuals altogether and just go for the most important thing, which is picking out the salient counterfactual possibility that's treated as a default to the actual circumstances. The Hitchcock and Knope theory appeals to non-occurrence counterfactuals to spell out the idea that causation is linked to difference making. So there's a very familiar idea that a cause is a difference maker. Well, how do you spell that out? Hitchcock and Knope say, well, we spell out that out in terms of a standard non-occurrence counterfactual. But I think that's a mistake. And use these standard non-occurrence counterfactuals, you then have to, you get the problem of generating all of these extra causes, and then you have to use a pragmatic filter to sort out the causes from the non-causes. I think it's best to avoid the standard counterfactuals in the analysis of difference making. So here's a very simple account that C is a difference making cause of E is true if there's a contrast pair A and C, where A is the actual situation and C is an appropriate default counterfactual situation, such that C and E are present in the actual situation but absent from the default counterfactual situation. Now, this, I should emphasize, this is just a very simplified theory. It's only really trying to deal with this cluster of problems. It doesn't deal with cases of preemption and overdetermination, a whole range of other problems. So I'm really just focusing on how can we explain this little cluster of problems that I've isolated. And I want to suggest that this is the right truth condition. And when you look at all the kind of range of examples that I've given, I think this provides a reasonable explanation of all the different examples. And it works roughly in the same way as the Hitchcock and Knope, but that's very, very rough. There are kind of lots of subtle differences that emerge when you look at the explanation of the particular examples. But let me just mention two, because there are two ways in which we can arrive at the judgment that there is no causation. So look at the absence of the meteor strike. So the absence of the meteor strike was a cause of my writing the paper. False, because there's no contrast pair with an appropriate default counterfactual situation. Because the salient default situation is one where I'm not struck by a meteor. That's the normal course of events. So there's no normal counterfactual possibility in which I am struck by a meteor. So in this particular case, there's no contrast pair in at the outset. Whereas if you look at a different kind of case, the Prince of Wales case, the unwanted positive cause case, here, to remind you, we want to say the prince's failure to water the plant caused the plant's death. The prince's eating the oaten biscuits didn't cause the plant's death. Well, the theory explains why we think the prince's eating the oaten biscuits was a cause of the plant's death is false. And that's because there is a contrast pair with a salient default counterfactual situation. This is a counterfactual situation where the prince doesn't eat the oaten biscuits, but in which he meets his obligation to water the plants. And in that case, we have a contrast pair between an actual and a counterfactual situation, which meets the difference-making condition. So there are two ways in which counterfactual causal judgment can be false. There's no contrast pair, and the second case, there is a contrast pair, but it doesn't meet the difference-making condition. Okay, so let me just sort of wrap this up with a final point. One of the things that I think that I like about the Hitchcock and Knobe paper is that they focus on a question about the function and role of the actual concept of causation. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a kind of background to this that Chris Hitchcock thinks that there's a thing called the objective causal structure, which is a given to us by a set of structural equations that are true of the situation that you're considering. And this set of structural equations encode a whole bunch of counterfactuals. That whole bunch of counterfactuals encode all the causal information about a situation that's relevant for the purposes of prediction and control. So, the puzzle arises, well, given that, why on earth do we have this weird concept of actual causation that, you know, has all these kind of strange kinks in it? It's a very kind of dog-legged concept. And why on earth would we have this concept? And that's what Hitchcock and Knobe attempt to answer in the paper. And the answer they give is, they say, through its connection with non-occurrence counterfactuals, the causal concept enables us to focus on what must be done to bring events into conformity with certain norms. So they say, in short, the concept of actual causation enables us to bring out appropriate targets for intervention. Now, as I've thought about this, the more I've found this mysterious. I just don't get this. I don't understand how this works as a rationale for the concept of actual causation. In many of the examples where we entertain counterfactuals and causal claims, we're talking about situations or about the actions of people that are not directly under our control. You know, the examples I've given about the prince and the queen, their actions are not under my practical control. I have no interest in intervening to bring their actions into conformity to norms. I don't want to intervene to make the prince water the plants. I'm interested in blaming the prince for not watering the plants. So the sort of picture that I have is the concept of actual causation. I should say that I agree with Chris and with Josh that all the kind of objective features of causation are encoded in these structural equations. And really, that's all we need for the purposes of prediction and control. But there's an interesting question about the concept of actual causation. I think the home of this concept is in our practices of explanation and attributing responsibility. Where we see some abnormal event, something which is a violation of a norm, then we seek explanation of that, or we seek to attribute responsibility to someone for that abnormal event. So in particular, if there's a violation of a statistical norm, something happens that's unexpected and surprising, we want to be able to explain that. When we see a violation of an ethical or social norm, we need to be able to attribute responsibility for that to someone. And if you think of a cause as something which makes a difference, that something occurs in actuality, an abnormal event in actuality, that makes the actual cause of events deviate from what would conform to the norm, then you have something which meets those purposes very, very nicely. So I think that the account that I want to write provides a much better account of the function and role of the concept of actual causation in our conceptual economy. And that's it. Yeah, okay. And so you would say something about the case of explanation of abnormal events. Sometimes there are things which are abnormal, which occur abnormally, and you know, the explanations for them are things that we don't have any direct control over. Why was there the earthquake in San Francisco in 1993? Or whenever we don't, so there.
But I think the notion of intervention would be like Jim's,
sure.
Intervention where it doesn't to say that the moon caused the tides to the moon's
sure.
Tides isn't to say that there's an actual
okay, that's good.
That kind of abstract sense. If you were going to intervene on something, if you wanted to.
Yeah. Okay.
What of all the things?
No, that's good. And actually, I find that helpful. I mean, because I accept that notion of intervention, and the general kind of the general way of trying to explain the function of the concept in terms of the way in which it provides us with targets for intervention, not just individually but communally. So that's good. I mean,
is quite consistent.
It is consistent, yeah. But it's providing a further rationale for why we have these practices of explanation and the attribution of responsibility. So it's going at a kind of deeper level than the explanation of function that I've given. Yeah, that's helpful. That's good.
Helen.
Yeah, I'm trying to fit all of this into Peter Robinson's kind of ideal thing. Because I'm having a bit of difficulty working out what course instruction business is doing. So one way you might, and I don't know if this is the right way to think of what digital media are doing, but one way you might think about what they're doing is, look, they have this kind of notion of what the results of project two are going to be, right? What are the kind of objective facts to which our ordinary intuitions might or might not match up? And that's the objective course instruction. So we fixed that. And now we have this question about what our ordinary intuitions are and how well they kind of map onto that structure, and to the extent that they don't, we now need to give a story about why they don't, right? So from the point of view of the objective order of structure, there's no difference between the gardener and the Queen of England and Europe, right? But then something you said made me think that isn't going on, and so I'm partly asking this about them and partly asking you about you. Made me think that wasn't what was going on, because the way you described it at one point was the notion of the objective causal structure, that's all kind of type causation stuff. And now we've got this kind of extra notion of kind of singular or token or actual causation. And that's kind of just left open by all the type stuff. So now we need to kind of consult our kind of ordinary intuitions to figure out kind of what the singular causal facts are. And that made it sound much more like a kind of a sort of a Lewisian project where you're using the ordinary intuitions as a kind of constraint on what the ordinary metaphysical, what the metaphysical story is. And that also seems to be in play in your, because you want to make some kind of a story about semantics rather than pragmatics. So I'm kind of just not quite sure what...
I'm not sure I have quite figured out how it maps onto Peter's typology. I think that the way Chris and Josh are working is that it's not that they are thinking of the kind of objective causal structure which is given by the structural equations. I suppose they think of that as capturing the kind of objective metaphysical facts about causation. So that is their view, and I guess I'm happy to accept that view as well. But then they notice that that there are all these kind of weird actual or token causal judgments that that are more fine-grained and selective than the causal judgments which are delivered by the structural equations. And they're trying to figure out, well, why would we have this concept of actual causation when so many of the things we want causation to do, namely to enable us to predict events and control events, are given by the structural equations. That's the sort of picture that they have, I think. Whereas my picture, I mean, I sort of mentioned stuff about structural equations just partly because in the kind of formal account that I use the structural equations. For me, my project in this paper is very much a type project one project, where I'm just trying to map out and understand the contours of the concept of token causation. And that's quite tricky. I mean, a lot of philosophers have kind of dismissed it and said, this is all rubbish. Put it in the pragmatic waste paper bin. The only interesting concept, the only metaphysically interesting concept of causation is an egalitarian one, according to which the queen's failure and the gardener's failure count as causes. And I find that unsatisfactory. I don't want to use metaphysical constraints to dismiss the project one. I think you've got to do the project one thoroughly, trying to understand all the contours of ordinary concept of causation. And then, maybe then you can ask, well, you can ask the project three question, how does a metaphysical picture map on to this complex ordinary usage? And then you can actually go on to the project four. You might sort of say, well, this concept of actual causation that Menzies and other people are investigating, it's just so weird, so kind of crazy, and so subjective, because the notion of normal conditions is just, you know, it's a hodgepodge of different considerations, statistical, ethical, norms of proper function. They all get mixed up in there, and it's just a crazy hodgepodge. Let's kind of sort of dispense with it. I mean, that's not my reaction, but I can imagine someone doing that. But I think I agree with Peter's sense of the priority. You've got to do the project one thoroughly before you can engage in projects two, three, and four.
Finger for Peter.
Actually, it's okay. But by the end of what Peter was just saying, I
covered
what I was going to say. So.
Okay. Then in that case, Toby.
First, could I recommend you a paper by Sarah McGrath? 2005 paper, causation by omission.
Yeah, no, this is, I know of this paper, I've got to go and read it, yeah.
I've always been irritated by Hitchcock and Noe, who clearly are aware of her work, not citing her at all. It completely anticipates their theory. It has some advantages, you just mentioned your variation on their theory of being more explicitly an analysis of causation rather than a sort of quasi psychological pragmatic account.
Right. And she uses, I gather from various references, she uses normative considerations too.
That's right.
In exactly working out a contrast. Does she use a kind of contrast set?
Yeah, prescriptive and descriptive norms gets too mixed up in the mind like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember if there's any other further subtleties distinguishing it, but it's extremely similar idea, and it seems to be a much neglected.
But
I just wanted to ask a bit more about what you thought the significance was of your saying that your theory appeals to counterfactual possibilities while avoiding the use of counterfactuals, because I'm not quite sure I see the force of that distinction. So if I look at your version of the analysis, C is a difference making cause of E, even only if there's a contrast pair A, C, where C is an appropriate default counterfactual situation. Doesn't that just mean where there is a true counterfactual of the form, were the cause not present and things were otherwise default or otherwise normal or something like that? Isn't there a pretty easy translation, as it were, between true counterfactuals of some sort and your counterfactual possibility?
Okay, that's good. It's a bit of a simplification to say that the theory doesn't use counterfactuals. What and in various versions of this theory, I've tried to use kind of ceteris paribus conditionals to pick out that default counterfactual condition. What's crucial is that the default counterfactual situation is what in the normal circumstances would occur in the absence of the cause. And that's actually different from what standard counterfactuals tell us about. They say what in the actual circumstances would occur if the cause were absent. So one way of putting it is that the theory does use counterfactuals, but they use ceteris paribus counterfactuals with an explicit normally operator. Normally, if the cause were absent, then thus and so. Whereas the standard counterfactuals that are used are all centered on the actual world. They tell us what would actually happen if the cause were absent. And that's different from what would normally happen if the cause were absent.
Suggesting that the better semantics for counterfactuals in direct causal reasoning is one that abandons the centering condition.
Yeah, yeah.
Does this idea about nesting the counterfactual under normal corresponds to that idea?
It is. I think that in various earlier papers I've fiddled around with a semantics where the centering, where the spheres of similarity are centered not on the actual world but on what I call a set of normal worlds or default worlds. And I think in the past I confusingly thought that semantics with the alternative centering was the right semantics for ordinary counterfactuals. And now I see I was completely mistaken about that. That rather the semantics with the spheres centered on the normal worlds is an appropriate semantics for ceteris paribus counterfactuals or counterfactuals that have a kind of explicit normally operator working. And actually since working on this, I've discovered a couple of other papers. There's a nice paper by Martin Smith and the Journal of Philosophical Logic a few years ago, and a nice paper by someone called Martin Moreau called Faint-Hearted Conditionals, where they use roughly the same idea to develop a semantics for conditionals that don't obey centering on the actual world. There are some interesting features of this special kind of counterfactual in that you have to give up modus ponens. It's a central feature of standard counterfactuals that modus ponens works, but it's not true for these kind of normally counterfactuals. Normally, if I strike the match lights, the match is struck, doesn't actually follow the match will light because there could be some violation of the normal conditions. So you have to give up modus ponens and a few other principles for these special sort of ceteris paribus counterfactuals. But yeah, I mean, strictly speaking, you're right. I was simplifying in order to try and make a dramatic point. Yes, I do have to use counterfactuals, but they're not the standard ones. They're these kind of very slightly weird ceteris paribus, normally counterfactuals.
Finger from Alistair.
Yeah, most of what I was putting in my hand has been covered in that. I just wondered whether or not the combination of drop-centric requirement with using something like a generic operator in the analysis might allow you to stick more closely to the counterfactual analysis rather than moving away from the counterfactual analysis. So a feature of generics is that typically A doesn't entail A in the actual world. So if you simply, rather than making all counterfactual generic in this way, build a generic operator into the analysis of causation in terms of counterfactuals, and combine that with drop-centric requirement, well, that effectively explains why the centric requirement is dropped in the causal case, but not more generally. That might get what you want while sticking more closely to the counterfactual form.
I think that's actually roughly what I have in mind, is that the semantics for the ceteris paribus conditionals are a bit like sort of hypothetical or generic conditionals, and I think the standard counterfactual semantics works. I mean, you have the nested spheres of possible worlds, but the spheres of possible worlds are not centered on the actual world, but on the most normal worlds, the kind of default worlds. So you actually have to give up. You have to give up the rule from P and Q is true to if P were the case, Q is the case. You have to give up that rule. You have to give up modus ponens. But all the other rules are the same rules as in the standard counterfactual logic. So you don't get strengthening of the antecedent, you don't get contraposition, you don't get transitivity. So it's very like the semantics for standard counterfactuals, except you have to give up the rules which actually go with the centering requirement.
Yeah. So you gave up your hand, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
My suggestion wasn't so much that you need to use a separate kind of counterfactual for which modus ponens wasn't valid, but you could keep modus ponens as a rule for counterfactuals. But when those counterfactuals are big, rather than just using a counterfactual analysis of causation, in the analysis of causation, in terms of counterfactuals, you add a generic operator in there. So the counterfactuals themselves are the same sort of counterfactuals, modus ponens are still valid for them, but as used in the analysis of causation, it just didn't seem you need two different kinds of counterfactuals there.
Yeah. Well, in some sense, I agree with you. Let's go to the very end. Where was that? I want the slide about Woodward. So here, if you were to replace those counterfactuals, which are a kind of standard Lewis counterfactuals, with one of these generic, hypothetical statements, which don't conform to centering, which are not centered on the actual world, but are centered on the normal worlds, then yes, I'd be happy to accept both one and two. So I agree with you.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Great. I just wanted to go back to the hodgepodge that you were talking about before. So it struck me that at least the drunken driver example carried a lot more kind of emotional baggage with it than a lot of the other examples. Like, we want to send the drunk driver to responsible, but it's much more squashing a bunch of norms, including statistical norms, with kind of like abnormal sort of responsibility or something like that, into a single, a single scale, as you said. What you get is some sort of trumping situations where if you translated the drunken driver situation to one which was just purely statistical, where there were no acting agents in it, where there were just a science case of like what happened, you know, why the dinosaurs died or why something happened in the past, and a less kind of morally weighty situation, you'd actually get a different judgment from people. So I wonder whether what's going on in some of these cases is because you're squashing all of these different norms into a single scale, you're actually getting different judgments because there's different things are trumping in different cases.
Yeah.
So it might be a case where, like, you know, there might be some sensible reform needed here to compare these cases equally.
Right, right. That's an interesting point. Look, it turns out on the account that I want to run that the drunk drivers running the red light counts as a cause of Mr. Jones's death, but also Mr. Jones's taking an unusual route home counts as a cause. There are actually different norms involved in those two cases. Now, I think what actually happens, I mean, sometimes we're just happy to have two things count as causes. But I think, especially if you're, when subjects are presented with the question, what caused this, there's kind of an emphasis, there's pressure on them to pick out a single cause. And then people are actually, then they make comparative judgments. And I think the comparative judgments are, well, which is the more abnormal? Is it Mr. Jones's taking the unusual route home, or is it the drunk drivers sort of running the red light? And I think what goes on is that people do think the violation of the ethical norm is more salient than the violation of the statistical norm. And you know, that's just a fact about human judgment. Now what you're saying is,
let's say there was a person was a drunk who ran red lights all the time.
Right.
It still seems that you want to put the responsibility on the driver, and it seems that's not because of that. It's an unusual, it's more unusual. In fact, it's more normal in this case than taking an unusual red light. So it seems to be because we want to give some sort of moral responsibility, or place moral responsibility for and on that person. So it seems to be
Look, it could be that that it depends very much on how the question is framed to people. If you're looking just for an explanation, a scientific explanation, of why the accident occurred and why Mr. Jones died, then his leaving, his going home by the unusual route and the drunk drivers running the red light should have kind of equal status. But, you know, quite often when these questions are put to subjects, the context is not made clear, and it's very easy for people then to interpret this as a context where you're trying to attribute responsibility. In that case, I think the drunk driver's action becomes more salient, because people think this is a case where you have to blame someone.
We've now got more people on the list than minutes, so I'd like to encourage you to be extremely careful. One person's dropped off, and I think we've now got the same number of people as minutes. John, you're next.
It's going to be minutes, or I'll pass.
You're passing too?
I'll pass.
Oh, okay. How do you, well, Lloyd?
This is probably a good question about Project One, in a sense. Do you think it's all, I think it does belong to the first project, the thorough examination. Is some counterfactual, and I do this before, seem to be ones that we're so confident of that we express it with the past indicative. Michael Dummett pointed this out. I mean, LBW is a good example. If an LBW is an LBW, it's commonly said, the ball was hitting leg stump. where the ball was going to get lynched on, or a base falls from mantelpiece, and I grab it, right, just in time, we say it was going to smash, or an arrow is headed right for the bullseye, and another arrow hits it. Mm-hmm. Say the arrow was hitting the bullseye. I mean, is there anything of interest for Project One in those cases where a counterfactual seems to be replaceable by a straight past continuous or past indicative? Because it doesn't work for all. In some we feel we have to use the wood, etc. And in some, and I'm just wondering whether there's any generally interesting feature of this situation which leads us to use different grammar for some cases.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure it's going to be relevant to my project, but I mean, it does.
It belongs to Project One. Yeah,
it certainly belongs to Project One, but it does seem as though the more certain we are of the counterfactual, the more likely we are to replace it with the past tense indicative. Yeah.
Do you think it's just certainty?
Well, I don't know. I haven't thought about it, to tell you the truth.
Carlos, I had a question about losing too many dependencies. On the standard counterfactual story, suppose the queen is very keen on these plants, so she tells the gardener to make sure he waters the plants. Independently, she tells the prince to make sure he waters the plants. Both of them don't discharge their obligations. On the standard counterfactual story, it's true that each of their failures is. But now, on your story about normality, what we've got to do is not look to the actual world, how things, but rather what the normal world, relevantly similar to the actual world. So if the normal world is one in which people carry out their obligations or whatever, then it looks like neither of them is going to be, neither of them is actually going to be responsible for the death of the plants, whereas in the standard counterfactual story, each of them is. Is that right, if I misunderstood?
I think that on my account, the default situation, I mean, so the prince and the gardener fail to water the plant. So in my view, what you've got to do is you've got to consider the default situation where both of them discharge their duty. I guess that would be a situation where both water the plant. And in that case...
What about the case where the counterfactual true, if he didn't water the plant, then it would be dead for either of them? It doesn't seem that counterfactual true.
So what was the counterfactual?
If he fails to water the plants, the plants die.
Yes.
That counterfactual looks on your sort of with the normality built in. That counterfactual looks false because you now go into a world which is normal. When a normal situation, the other guy would have watered the plants. See, in the standard counterfactual, because we've got centering, and because we have the deviant aspects of the actual world that we're holding to and considering counterfactual, deviating from that, we understand why that counterfactual is true. But in your story, that's not going to be true, as I understand, unless I misunderstand it well.
If you take it individually, if you take them individually, then both will count. Their failure will count as causes.
Perhaps, but how do you get your counterfactual come out true? Is the normal, in that case, include the failure of the other guy?
Yeah. So, okay. So, the default situation... So the actual situation is where the both fail. The default situation is where they both do their job, okay. And in the actual situation, the plant dies. In the default situation, because both of them water, the plant survives. So it actually turns out to be the case that they're both their failures, That's actually the joint failure counts as the cause of the plant's death. So I think the theory does work in this case.
Okay, so the case I'm interested in, I mean, I accept that when they both water it survives, and on your story that counterfactual's right with normality built in. But I guess I'm trying to get from you an explanation of why the conditional, if the prince fails to water the plant in the normal situation, it dies. If it fails to water the plant, the normal situation dies. But it looks like in the normal situation, potentially the one which the gardener's going to have done is carried out his obligations.
Yeah, I see the problem. This has come from my conceding to Toby that I'm going to use these counterfactuals.
We're pretty much out of time.
It's plausible in cases of diffuse collective responsibility. You can say, the fact that nobody watered it caused it to die, but it wasn't the fact that Peter failed to water it that caused it. It wasn't the fact that Mark Michaelis failed to water it that caused it. It was just our collective failure. That's why we have trouble ascribing responsibility to individuals in cases where we fail to form things that we think are collectively desirable good. So I think you should think this actually matches our uncertainty about ascribing individual responsibility for collective acts, where normally the collective looks after it, but if the collective fails to, it's hard to know which individual or maybe there's no individual to blame.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's I like that as a first response.
I know you're itching to come back on this point, but we are now 5 minutes over time. So I think we should thank Peter. Go and have some coffee and start again a little.